Hi, it's Robin Young. Thank you for listening to Here and Now. If you love to listen to your favorite shows, hear your favorite stories, and NPR is your personal connection to the world, keep your love for public radio alive. Visit donate.npr.org/now to give, and then tell the world why you're passionate about listening by tweeting or posting on Facebook with #WhyPublicRadio.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And I'm Lisa Mullins. It's Here and Now. Republicans in Congress have eliminated a key part of the Affordable Care Act in their tax bill, the individual mandate. Here's President Trump speaking yesterday.
So in this bill, not only do we have massive tax cuts and tax reform, we have essentially repealed Obamacare.
Well, that's not entirely accurate. It's true that Americans would no longer be penalized if they don't have health insurance, but there are many aspects of Obamacare that live on. To give us the overview now, here's Julie Rovner, who's chief Washington correspondent for Kaiser Health News. Hi, Julie.
Hi, Lisa.
Let's start off with the individual mandate. What does it mean that it's now gone or soon will be?
Well, analysts actually disagree about what it means. If you'd asked them back in 2012 when the Supreme Court was deciding if it was unconstitutional, they would have said that the law could not exist without it. But in the several years we've had with it actually in place, even the Congressional Budget Office thinks that it's not having as big an impact on getting healthy people to sign up as things like giving them premium subsidies have had. So I think most analysts now think that it won't take the law apart, although it certainly won't help matters.
Okay. And we should say this is the fact that people can be penalized for if they don't have health insurance.
That's right.
And so this will not be in effect until 2019 anyway under the mandate, correct?
That's right. And that's very confusing for people. So they'll have basically two tax years where they will still be required to show that they had health insurance. The taxes that they file next April from 2017 and the taxes they file the following April from 2018. So if you're in a state that hasn't closed enrollment yet and you haven't signed up, you're still required to have health insurance. And if not, you will pay a penalty unless something subsequent changes that.
The Congressional Budget Office has been keeping tabs on how many people could lose health coverage as a result of the individual mandate being repealed. What's the latest count by CBO?
They've said that over 10 years, 13 million fewer people would have health insurance. Some of them would drop it voluntarily because they only bought it because of the possible penalty. Some would drop it because insurers are likely to raise prices because they won't have as many healthy people and they'll be priced out. And some people could lose it because they'll live in areas where there are no more health insurers offering coverage. So there simply won't be anything available. CBO hasn't broken down how many people fall into each of those categories.
What are insurance companies saying in response to all this?
Well, the insurance companies are obviously not very happy. This was something that they really wanted. They wanted an even stronger mandate. The penalties are not that high, even now that they're fully phased in, because they felt like they needed, if they were going to have to sell to people with pre-existing health conditions, they needed some encouragement, inducement, requirement for healthy people to buy coverage too, and not just wait until they got sick to buy coverage. So without the mandate, we're going to have to watch what insurance companies do. Clearly, they'll raise premiums to offset for a sicker population. But the question is, will they simply drop out of some of the places where they are now? We almost saw that this year, but we didn't quite. There's still an insurer in every county.
I want to talk about another critical part of the Affordable Care Act that has been that 26-year-olds could be on their parents' health plan. Is that provision still in under the Republicans' tax reform?
Yes, the only thing that the Republicans changed was the penalty for the individual mandate. Ironically, the individual mandate itself remained. They couldn't take that out because of the budget procedure that they were using. So everything else that was in the Affordable Care Act, the children on 26 staying on their up to 26 staying on their parents' health plans, the subsidies to help people buy insurance,
coverage for pre-existing conditions,
the types of benefits that plans have to offer, all of those things are still intact.
There's a separate note now that Congress is working on a short-term spending bill to avoid a government shutdown. It could happen by the end of the day tomorrow unless there is some kind of action. A short-term plan would keep the government open through January 19th. The bill unveiled this morning includes a temporary patch for what's known as CHIP, the Children's Health Insurance Program. It covers 9 million children and pregnant women across the country. Lawmakers let CHIP funding expire at the end of September, and that raised the ire of some in Congress. Last week, Republican Senator Jerry Moran of Kansas urged his peers to reinstate that money.
Now's the time to act, to provide some certainty and to make sure that the funds continue to be available. In Kansas, that's in the absence of that, that would be leaving about 79,000 children without coverage or other good options.
Julie, that money that is in the temporary bill would extend funding for these children and pregnant women only until the end of March. This program has bipartisan support, so why is it even at issue?
It's a very good question. And all year, lawmakers said, we'll get to it, we'll get to it, we'll get to it. It's important. Then they let it expire. And they said, well, states have enough money to get through the end of the year. We'll do it in December. Well, now states are running out of money. They haven't done it. The fight is over how to pay for it. Unlike the tax bill, which is unpaid for, Republicans are requiring that the costs be offset. They want to offset them by changing payments for Medicare and taking public health money out of the Affordable Care Act. Democrats don't like that. So they're at this standoff that everybody wants the program to continue. It's just how they'll make up the money and if they'll make up the money.
Last question, since you've been watching this so carefully, back to the Affordable Care Act. What's your larger take on what's happening here?
I think people are kind of surprised. If you'd said at the beginning of the year that the president would cut off the insurer subsidies for people with low incomes and that Congress would repeal the individual mandate and that the law would still be standing, basically, I think a lot of people would have shaken their heads. And yet that's exactly what's happened. The law has proved to be much more resilient than I think most people thought. You know, both supporters and opponents thought the law is still there. The Republicans have now basically taken out the only part of the law that was truly unpopular. That's the requirement for most people to have insurance. So what's left is quite popular. Republicans want to change it, but I think they're going to find it's going to be just as hard next year as it was this year.
Julie Rovner, Chief Washington Correspondent for Kaiser Health News. Thanks, Julie.
You're most welcome.
The Census Bureau has just released some new population data that includes the list of the fastest growing states in the country. The winner is Idaho. That state's population grew 2.2% between July 1st of last year and July 1st of this year. Three other western states saw similar growth during that period: Nevada, Utah, and Washington. For more, we're joined by Molly Cromwell, a demographer with the U.S. Census Bureau. And Molly, is this the first time that Idaho has topped your list of the fastest growing states?
Yes. This is the first time that Idaho has been the fastest growing state, at least in a decade.
And when you look at that, in addition to the other fast-growing states, Nevada, Utah, Washington State, Florida, Arizona, what is driving that growth?
So in Idaho, what we're seeing is domestic migration is the primary factor driving that population growth. We're also seeing that in Nevada, domestic migration is the primary factor driving that growth. But in Utah, which is the third fastest growing state this year, natural increase or more births than deaths is a driving factor.
Interesting. And you broke down the country into four regions in this report: Northeast,
yes,
Midwest, South, and West. How did they rank in terms of population growth?
So regionally, the South and the West are growing the fastest. The Northeast and the Midwest are still growing, but they make up a smaller share of the United States population as time goes on. What we're seeing is that overall, more people are moving away from the Northeast and the Midwest, and more people are moving into the South and the West.
Which states are losing population the fastest?
States that are losing population the fastest are Illinois and West Virginia this year.
Hmm. And as an Illinoisan, I know that we've always been very close in population with the state of Pennsylvania.
Yes.
But Pennsylvania has just overtaken Illinois by just a bit, but they
did
in this survey.
Yes, that's right. I believe the change was around 3,000.
What about overall in the United States right now? The population up 2.3 million over the last year.
Yeah, nationally, we're seeing that the population growth is decelerating over the past few years. This coincides with a decrease in the number of births and an increase in the number of deaths.
But what about international migration?
So international migration, we saw a slight decrease of 1.8%. But it's important to remember that we're still seeing roughly 1.1 million international migrants entering the country every year.
Did anything in the results surprise you?
So when we talk about the fastest growing populations, we're looking at the speed of growth specifically, which is influenced by the size of the population. For example, both the West and the South saw 1% growth in 2017, But while the South had more than twice as much growth from migration than the West, it's because the population was almost twice as large.
That's Molly Cromwell, who is a demographer with the Census Bureau. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
And we'll link you to more census data at our website, hereandnow.org. Molly Cromwell mentioned the nation's population growth rate is slowing down, in part due to an increase in the number of deaths. Well, new data out today from the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention show the country's average life expectancy dropped in 2016 for the second year in a row. It is now 78.6 years. One leading reason for the decline, a 21% jump in drug overdose deaths, including a surge in the number of deaths from synthetic opioids like fentanyl. The CDC says last year 63,600 people died of drug overdoses, about two-thirds of them opioid-related. That's more than the number of deaths from the flu, pneumonia, kidney disease, or breast cancer. The rate of overdose deaths was up across all age groups, but was highest among people aged 25 to 54. The states with the highest drug overdose death rates were West Virginia, Ohio, New Hampshire, and Pennsylvania, along with the District of Columbia. The new film The Post opens in theaters beginning tomorrow. It centers around the Washington Post decision to publish the Pentagon Papers, which detailed ways that four presidential administrations deceived the American people about the Vietnam War. The Nixon administration had already put an injunction on the New York Times to stop publication, but in this scene, Post reporters are given a partial copy.
Huh. Are these in order?
I don't think so.
There are no page numbers.
Yeah, that's where the top secret stamps were. My source had to cut them off.
We're supposed to retire on Friday.
Ben, how are we supposed to comb through 4,000 pages?
They're not even loosely organized.
The Times had 3 months. There's no way we can possibly
He's
get
right.
this. He's
right. We got less than 8 hours.
We could shoot for City, then we'd have 10. Hey,
the Post stars Meryl Streep as Washington Post publisher Catherine Graham and Tom Hanks as editor Ben Bradley. Liz Hanna co-wrote the screenplay with Josh Singer, and she joins us now. Liz Hanna, welcome.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
And by the way, you're a first-time screenwriter. You wrote this script. Now it's a film directed by Steven Spielberg starring Meryl Streep and Tom Hanks. Was this a shock to you that it turned into such a big thing?
Yeah, no, I totally was sitting at my kitchen table thinking, like, obviously these are the people who are going to make this movie.
Right.
It was a total shock. I mean, sort of every step of the way was a shock to me. Steven and Tom and Meryl and then Josh and then sort of every step along the way has been it's been very shocking.
Well, where did the idea for this screenplay come from?
It originated with Catherine Graham herself. I read her book, Personal History, which is her Pulitzer Prize winning memoir that she wrote. And I read it when I was in my early 20s and I just sort of fell in love with her voice. She had a really unique way of looking at her life and reflecting on her past that was sort of similar to something I needed to read in my early 20s. You know, she was very honest about being insecure and very honest about the mistakes she'd made and very honest about analyzing her sort of choices. And it was sort of refreshing to read a book about somebody who wasn't saying that they were right all the time. It all really started there.
What were the mistakes that you found that she made and what mistakes did you try to put forth in this film?
Well, I think her insecurity was something that we really were taken by and something that we really tried to explore in this. You know, she grew up in a time that really the word feminism didn't exist yet. You know, she was raised in a world where she was educated enough to take care of her family and to take care of the house and was never intended to really run a company. And so she was very insecure about that. You know, one of the things she had talked about in her book was that she always regretted not going to Harvard Business School because she thought that that was something that would really have, you know, helped her be suited for the job, whereas she was actually the person in the room who understood the newspaper business and everything that went into the Washington Post better than any of the people at the table. So there was this interesting dichotomy in her of sort of deep down she was this very strong-willed woman, but she had been kind of raised to tamper that down.
Let's listen to a clip from the film. This is Tom Hanks as the editor, Ben Bradley, coming to Catherine Graham's home to tell her that they're getting a copy of the Pentagon Papers.
Do you have the papers?
Not yet.
Oh, gosh, because, you know, the position that would put me in, You know, we have language in the prospectus.
Yeah, I know that the bankers can change their mind. That's, and I know what is at stake. You know, the only couple I knew that both Kennedy and LBJ wanted to socialize with was you and your husband, and you own the damn paper.
You know, one of the things I thought was so interesting in this film was this conflict on the part of somebody like Katharine Graham, who publishes The Washington Post, between the editorial side of things and the business side of things, both of which she has to think about.
Yeah, that was something that we really sort of were so attracted to, this idea that, you know, Bradley's relationship to JFK is, you know, I think very widely documented. He wrote a book about his relationship with Kennedy. And Kay Graham's husband put LBJ on the ticket with Kennedy. Mm-hmm. You know, these relationships were extremely personal. They were very deep. For the majority of the time in D.C. at this point, a lot of decisions were made at the dinner tables that these women were throwing. You know, they were sort of known for throwing these parties where people would mingle and meet and they would have the conversations they needed to have that they couldn't have necessarily maybe in the West Wing or the White House. And so, you know, having to come down to this moment where they're making that choice, where they, you know, very, I think, clearly drew the line that said, okay, no longer are we going to, if we have, cut you slack for being our friends. We have to decide if this is right for the people to know. If this is more important than our friendship, because it will, you know, I mean, Robert McNamara put every single board member on Kay Graham's Washington Post board. So This was a very intimate decision. And that, for Josh and I, just really amplified the meaning of it.
Robert McNamara, of course, the defense secretary at the time. And by the way, you know, Katharine Graham was having to deal with a paper that was going public in a stock sale that could be jeopardized if she made the wrong decision on the Pentagon Papers.
Yeah, there's actually in the offering, there's a stipulation that says if a critical event occurs, I think that's the terminology, if a critical event occurs, the offering can be canceled. And in the fine wording of it, a federal indictment is in there. So they were very clearly, you know, when they make this decision, they were very clearly aware that this may not only jeopardize her role and Ben's role, this may kill the paper.
Now, your co-writer on this screenplay, Josh Singer, won an Oscar for being the screenwriter for Spotlight, the film about the Boston Globe investigation into the Catholic Church sex abuse scandal in Boston. How did that movie impact what you were doing here? Because they're obviously both about these major newspapers breaking big stories.
Sure. I mean, you know, I think one of the things is that Josh not only is an incredible writer, but he has an enormous amount of experience in this world. So we were able to speak to Marty Baron, you know, who was at the Boston Globe actually at the time of Spotlight and is now at the Washington Post. So that was amazing, being able to vet the script through people. You know, one of the things that's scary about writing a movie about journalists is they are going to pick exactly what's wrong and they will tell you about it. And so we wanted to make sure that it was as not only as truthful as possible to history, but as authentic as possible to what the dynamics of a press room are and things like that.
Have you gotten any pushback from journalists about this film, about anything that you didn't get right?
No. You know, what's amazing is we had an amazing amount of access, not only with the Post, but with the Graham family and the Bradleys. And so we were able to really vet it. And then on set, we had Len Downey, who took over the paper after Ben left, was on set with us for a long time. And he would tell us, you know, not only sort of the wrong things that we were doing if there was something about journalism, but he'd every now and then be like, yeah, Ben would never say that. And so, you know, he knew Ben and Kay really well. So that was, he was sort of our technical slash, you know, human consultant. But also, you know, we just premiered the film in D.C. last week. And the response, I think has been, for me, has been really wonderful. You know, the only thing that I worried about, or not that I worried that we didn't, but the thing I was most concerned about was I wanted everybody who knew Kay to feel like we got her right, because she's never been depicted on film before. And that was something that we really, everyone involved, we really wanted to get her right. And so we've heard from a few, not only the family, but from people who knew her, that it feels like we got her right. So that's kind of like the best cherry on top of anything.
Well, you can't do much better than Meryl Streep in trying to get a character right. I was watching that and thinking, gosh, she has played so many different famous people over the years.
Yeah, she really undertook it with such an amount of, an immense amount of respect. She would listen to Kay's, you know, luckily Kay reads her memoir in the audiobook. So she would listen to Kay's memoir constantly to get her voice, to get her, not just the inflections, but sort of you can tell the moments that are important for Kay to be talking about, the moments that are maybe more emotional or that she feels a certain way about. And so that was, I think, a wonderful gift for everybody that we could listen to those tapes. And I think for Meryl, too, to be able to have Kay's voice, you know, really there talking about these things that we were making a movie about was really amazing. But, you know, really, you can't go wrong when Meryl can read the phone book and it sounds good.
What about releasing this film in the current climate? Not just a film about the press versus Washington, but in particular, the Washington Post, which is like enemy number one of President Trump in the White House right now.
It's been sort of strange to watch some things that took place in 1971 seem slightly reminiscent of things that are happening now. But, you know, here's the thing. History is cyclical, and sometimes it's good to look back on history to see that, you know, not only did we get out of it, not necessarily unscathed, but maybe with a little more knowledge and a little more experience, and also to look back and say, well, okay, how did we get out of it? What happened? You know, what can we do to sort of see where we can go from here?
It also reminds us as we look back at history that it was a lot harder to make newspapers before computers as I watch your film. I don't know how they did that every day.
It's also it gives you such a weight, I feel like, about what the story is that you're going to print because it takes so long. You know, you can't just hit a button anymore. You can't just – and then it's out into the world to millions of people. This was – you know, a part of this film is really about – the deadline, you know, you have to print by you have to get the story in by a certain time. You have to print by a certain time to make the edition, to make it go out in the morning. And it gives this real gravity to how news was mass produced in that time and distributed. And I think that is something that we kind of forget is, you know, I can go on Twitter and have literally a million different stories in 25 seconds. Whereas then it was, you know, you get your paper. That's what your paper says is what you know. And you go from there.
That's Liz Hanna, who is the co-screenwriter of the new film, The Post. It opens in theaters tomorrow. Liz, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much. Have a good one.
Thanksgiving Day belongs to football, and Christmas Day is becoming a day for basketball. There are five, count them, five pro basketball games this Christmas. Here and Now sports analyst Mike Pesca is here to talk about this trend in the NBA. He hosts the daily podcast, The Gist, at Slate.com. Hi, Mike.
Hi. Oh, Linus Van Pelt. He would just be so sad to hear you say that Christmas has become synonymous with basketball. I'd give you a little lecture.
Exactly. It's all about that little tree. Well, yeah. How did basketball on Christmas become a thing?
You know, that's the schedule. Christmas is a winter event, but basketball is a winter sport. Goes back to the Knicks playing the Providence Steamrollers, and they've been doing it basically forever. And since basketball's pretty smart about marketing and taking advantage of what they have, they've been really emphasizing the Christmas games, using them as a showcase. And in fact, when there was a lockout a few years ago, the very first games were played on Christmas. So they know what they have in the Christmas games, and what they have is a very good marketing opportunity.
Does that mean that it's supposed to be an honor for NBA players and teams to have to work on Christmas since nobody else wants to?
Yeah, well, I mean, I also assume like the people who are working at the Target to sell the last minute gifts feel so honored. But yes, because they pick the marquee matchups, and if you're in a Christmas game, more people will be watching you. And if you're, say, a member of the San Antonio Spurs, which are always one of the best teams and almost never gets picked for a Christmas game, it just adds to the feeling of slightedness that you always experience.
Okay, so, and by the way, there's no trouble getting anybody in the stands, I take it.
No, because they're such great teams.
So the big matchup, the biggest of the big on Christmas Day Monday, is the Golden State Warriors against the Cleveland Cavaliers, two of the best teams in the NBA over the past 3 years. How's this year's matchup looking?
Yep. Those are the two teams who faced each other in the finals 3 years in a row. And this will be the third year in a row. They're the marquee matchup on Christmas. And they're still probably the two best teams or the two most likely teams to reach the finals. And last year's game is widely agreed between those two to be the greatest Christmas game ever, Christmas Day game ever. Well, we could see something like that this year.
So they're an easy pick. But how about less established teams? Is the NBA using the data showcase up-and-coming ones?
They are, and that's why you have the Knicks and the 76ers, beyond the fact that they're just from big markets. Finally, these two teams that have been terrible for so long at least have winning records and are promising. The very last game of the slate includes the Timberwolves and the Lakers. The Lakers aren't very good, but they're showing more promise. The Timberwolves are an exciting team that the league wants to draw attention to.
How are TV ratings for the NBA on Christmas Day? Anything like football on Thanksgiving?
They're very good, and this year ratings for the NBA in general are up tremendously, 30%. And my theory is that they are a league that just understands how America consumes media now. They have embraced social media. They have embraced Twitter. They're not afraid of putting their product out there in a way that's accessible to fans. And there's so much less grumpiness associated with the NBA. Football's just a grumpy sport where everyone's upset with everyone else, and baseball's all about being slighted and breaking the rules and throwing a pitch at a guy who does something.
That's
to break
what
an
it's all about.
Yeah, basketball's mostly about joy. It's about expression. You can see the players. I really think it's just the sport that fits in with 2017 the best.
Okay, thank you. Nice to talk to you. Mike Pesca, here and now sports analyst. He hosts the daily podcast, The Gist, at Slate.com. Thanks again, Mike.
You're welcome.
This morning, President Trump tweeted more praise for Fox News. Quote, "Was Fox and Friends just named the most influential show in news? You deserve it. Three great people. The many fake news hate shows should study your formula for success." He was referring to the website Mediaite, which named the show's hosts most influential because President Trump watches their show and tweets about it. The president's relationship with Fox News and the media were a big part of David Folkenflik's life in 2017, and he joins us now to look back. Hi, David.
Hey, Jeremy, you're not kidding.
Really? And we're waiting to see right now, by the way, if President Trump will hold a year-end news conference and take questions from reporters. He hasn't done that in a while. The last extended news conference he held was in August. Here he is fielding questions from CNN's Jim Acosta during that press conference following the violent white nationalist rally in Charlottesville.
Mr. President, can you explain why you did not condemn those hate groups by name over the weekend?
They've been condemned. They have been condemned.
And why are we not having a press conference today? You said on Friday we had a press conference.
We had a press conference.
We just had a press conference. Can we ask you some more questions, then, sir?
It doesn't bother me at all, but you know, I like real news, not fake news. Get fake news.
Thank you, everybody.
It's a little hard to hear there with the clicking cameras there, David, but as you listen to that, how would you describe this president's relationship with the press in 2017?
I think it's fraught, it's rough, at times it's brutal. It is largely rhetorically brutal. You know, there have been times at which Trump has seemingly tried to put his thumb on the scale rhetorically about, for example, the sale of CNN's parent company, Time Warner, to AT&T, the telecommunications giant. And you've seen his Justice Department take AT&T to court to try to stop or slow that down, to affect that in some ways. You know, there's been the targeting of reporters by name, which I think is really a pernicious thing to do for somebody who has, so you know, the most powerful megaphone in the world. And somewhat, you know, if you really think about the role of leadership in the country, a somewhat contemptible thing to do. Not that one can't take issue with journalists. They do their work for public consumption. Not that they can't be criticized. But the way in which he does it seems to me to be targeting them personally and attacking them rather savagely in terms of the rhetoric. And I think it you see the effects of it abroad, where places like in Turkey, I think you've seen the regime heartened by the rhetoric they're hearing about the White House towards the press. press, and you're seeing their willingness to go aggressively out of reporters and critics, both domestic and those employed even by American news outlets. And I think that's problematic. So I think you've seen a hardening. You know, there was this interesting analysis that came out today from a journalism professor and lawyer, Jonathan Peters, where he was given by a grad student essentially a database of all the tweets that Trump has done about the press since he, you know, started really to run for office in 2015. I think he did just 10 shy of the press as of the analysis. And this morning we've seen one or two more, you know, the 990 some tweets about the press,
right.
Almost all of them negative.
Well,
it tells you a little something about where he's coming from.
But the positive tweets about the press do tend to go to Fox News from this president. And I was thinking back to the campaign. There was a moment before he became president when he and Fox News were not on the same page at all. How did that relationship turn into what it is? And who sets the agenda each day, Fox News or the White House?
It's a really good question. I think that, you know, I think that the barriers and the boundaries, really the amorphous membrane separating the opinion side of Fox in particular, but Fox and the White House's messaging has all but evaporated. And I think that at times it's Fox figures, Jeanine Pirro, Sean Hannity, and others. You know, Trump is on the phone with people like this all the time at Fox and Friends folks. They're on the phone and they are giving him messages and sort of trying them out on the air. And you see minutes later him often or a few hours later him often trotting them out in tweets and occasionally in his public statements. There is not a separation there. It's not that Fox is coming at things from a conservative point of view. It's that they are bolstering him and his hardest, most faithful core, even at a time of great tumult and controversy. The crazy thing is, you know, the late Roger Ailes was a figure in both politics and media, a conservative force, a guy who thought about journalism as power, which is not really a journalistic imperative. But who would have thought that his ouster for sexual harassment a year and a half ago in the summer of 2016 would lead to a news organization lead to this particular organization, I should say, being more hardcore on the side of the Republican nominee and then president than ever before. You know, Rupert Murdoch made a very conscious and in some ways calculated decision, not one born of passion for Trump, but one of the decision that he would fare better and have greater access if he put his cards all down, his chips all in on Donald Trump. And this year you've seen that just one time after another. And Murdoch has essentially unlimited access to the president through his own conversations and also through those of his hosts.
Well,
so you've got a connection there like you've never seen.
You mentioned the sexual harassment allegations against Roger Ailes. We have to talk about the sexual harassment allegations that have come out across the media landscape this year, of course, starting with the film mogul Harvey Weinstein in October, but there has been a steady stream of men stepping down or being fired amid allegations, including Charlie Rose. Let's listen here to CBS This Morning co-anchors Gail King and Nora O'Donnell's reaction to that news.
Well, I know you and I have talked a lot about this, and it takes a lot of courage for these women to come forward, and I think that they should continue to do something.
We hope that they will continue to speak up.
Yeah. I also want to say this, that this is a moment that demands a frank and honest assessment about where we stand and more generally the safety of women. Let me be very clear. There is no excuse for this alleged behavior. It is systematic and pervasive. And I've been doing a lot of listening and I'm going to continue to do that. This I know is true. Women cannot achieve equality in the workplace or in society until there is a reckoning and a taking of responsibility. I'm really proud to work at CBS News. There are so many incredible people here, especially on this show, all of you here. This will be investigated. This has to end. This behavior is wrong.
David, your thoughts on this moment in the media, not just at CBS, but at NBC, at NPR, at WBUR, all across the landscape.
I think it is a moment of reckoning. I think the only question is, will this lead to systemic changes that endure or simply a convulsion that consumes much of the nation and workplaces across the country but doesn't fundamentally alter things in the years ahead for people like my daughters. You know, what is the landscape going to look like 25 years out? I think when there's the Clarence Thomas, Anita Hill hearings and sexual harassment was brought in as a subject to living rooms across the country, people thought things would have changed. But I don't think you can say that it really did if you're looking at the number of prominent men in a number of fields. And I think that number is only going to grow being held to account and being essentially like, you know, these stars being shot out of the sky and for a good cause.
One more thing I have to ask you about, and that is the newspaper business. This year, they have broken so many stories, from the allegations of sexual harassment to the Roy Moore allegations that were broken by The Washington Post, Politico, which isn't a newspaper technically, but kind of is.
Sure, it
broke
is.
That story about Tom Price using private planes, the Health and Human Services Secretary, that got him fired. They had a big year of breaking stories.
This is a time of, I think, where when you've got a government that is so hostile to transparency, it's hostile to accountability, it's hostile to accuracy in the information it does disclose. I think that the press has to be charged to perform its mandate of accountability or get out of the business. I think this is a moment where news organizations have to step up. And I think that it's important to realize that it's being done impressively often on the national level, even as it's almost overwhelming the volume of disclosures of things that need to be covered. But at the state capital level, as local smaller newspapers retrench and get cut back by corporate owners that are distant, I think a lot is going to get unexamined. I think it's really a moment where news organizations and people who care about accountability and good government really think hard about what they're allowing to happen at these 50 capitals around the country too.
Just a few seconds left, David, but prediction for 2018, what are we going to be talking about in the media world next year?
Well, I think there's lots going to be more of same, more Trump attacks on the press, particularly as things get tougher for him, more likely consolidation in the media, more impunity abroad from foreign leaders taking their cues. And I think you're going to see a lot more media figures, men, to fall, both moguls and executives. The one thing I think that'll be really interesting to watch is Trump's relationship not with the press but with the conservative and right-wing press, the Foxes, the Breitbarts, the Sinclairs. If he starts really to lose them, I think he's going to lose his hold. On his base as well.
That's NPR media correspondent David Falkenflik. David, thanks as always.
You bet.
There are thousands of elm streets in America, but not many elm trees for which the streets were named. In the mid-1900s, elm disease, Dutch elm disease, killed off millions of the species. Many were old and established trees, so when they came down, towns and forests were noticeably changed. These days, new invasive pests and diseases are killing off other species of trees, so ecologists are engineering a comeback for the American elm to help fill the gap. Jill Kaufman from New England Public Radio reports.
Long before the Puritans came to the New World, American elm trees grew wild. They were admired and used by Native people. Much later, they became part of a designed urban landscape, as Thomas Campanella told Wisconsin Public Radio. He's the author of a history of the elm called Republic of Shade.
Charles Dickens actually talked about this when he visited New Haven. New Haven was known as the City of Elms. It had a remarkable collection of elm trees on all its streets. And he wrote that the elms, quote, bring about a kind of compromise between town and country, as if each had met the other halfway and shaken hands upon it.
In the 20th century, a fungus known as Dutch elm disease, which attacks the tree through a beetle, killed millions of elms, but not all.
It's one of the biggest elms left in Massachusetts.
In the front yard of a small house in Amherst, Massachusetts, Christian Marks, a forest ecologist with the Nature Conservancy, stands near a huge elm. It's about 100 feet tall, about 100 years old.
And it has the classic elm shape where it has all this flare at the bottom from the roots.
Most elms that survived, like this one, have over the years been treated with an antifungal agent. Some that stood alone were never infested. It was the 1930s when the elms started to visibly die off. By the 1990s, three-quarters of them were gone. Marx says a certain beauty was lost.
When there were still avenues where the whole avenue was lined with elms, they would connect above the street and there would be branches all above you, and it felt like a vaulting ceiling of a cathedral.
Bringing back the elm is not just about recreating a beautiful landscape. These species will serve a function when they get to a point where they can resist pathogens. Marx is among the tree ecologists working with federal government projects to grow and plant a new population of disease-resistant elms. They'll help replace other species now in jeopardy, like maples, vulnerable to the Asian longhorn beetle, and ash, which are being killed off by the emerald ash borer. Keith Nislow is with the U.S. Forest Service in Massachusetts.
And so our strong focus on entomology and pests and pathogens allows us to do really robust projections about what would be lost.
What is lost when trees are killed off is what Nislow refers to as goods and services that come from nature's complex systems, from the shade up top down to the tree roots that filter pollutants.
And so then we have a pretty good idea of what a species that could come in and stand in and provide those services.
Right now, that's the American elm. The species is one of those more bang-for-your-buck kind of trees. The elm is fast-growing. It thrives in marshy meadows and along the riverbanks of wet floodplain forests, but it can also tolerate drought and city life. There is a large-scale, long-term restoration effort underway. It began in Ohio, moved to the Mid-Atlantic, the South, and New England.
We're taking them from this size container and putting them in a bigger one and growing them on to 4 to 6 feet.
Glenn Cutting and his family will be tending to these tiny elms at their nursery about 25 miles north of Amherst. Mark's started some of them from branches.
And you can see the label here where this is the mother, R18-2. It's highly tolerant selection. And then number 65 is a tree from New England that was really big and lived a long time despite Dutch elm disease being all around it. So we suspect it might be tolerant.
The more plush-looking ones, Mark says, he grew from seed. And he has other trees growing in a Vermont field and some in a more urban setting.
My name is Alexander Sherman, and I am the assistant city forester for the city of Springfield, Mass.
Sherman is standing at the edge of a well-groomed field. About 100 elms grown by Marks are among the trees here.
These are Christian trees, yep. He brought them down and in his car. He had them all packed in, and they're planters, and we had some volunteers out
these
here.
These elms are just a couple of feet tall. It will be another 5 years or so before they'll be ready to plant in neighborhoods, Sherman says. And it will be a few decades before researchers will know for sure if the American elm can once again join other trees lining America's streets. For Here and Now, I'm Jill Kaufman.
And another story we're following, a vote today in the United Nations. The General Assembly voted overwhelmingly to reject the Trump administration's decision to recognize Jerusalem as Israel's capital. The vote was 128-9 with 35 abstentions. The White House has warned that it'll be taking names and will remember this vote when the U.S. is asked to contribute to the U.N. The countries that voted with the U.S., by the way, Guatemala, Honduras, Israel, Marshall Islands, Micronesia, Nauru, Palau, and Togo. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And I'm Lisa Mullins. It's Here and Now.